Welcome to the New Books Channel in Art. My name is Kirsten Ellsworth, and today I have the pleasure of speaking with three curators involved with an exhibition on Marsden-Hartley. And today they're also going to speak with us about the beautifully illustrated and written catalog Marsden-Hartley to accompany the exhibition. And currently, or the exhibition is a 2017 at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. And I'd like to begin by asking each of you to talk a little bit about your backgrounds.
Great. Thanks, Kirsten. My name is Beth Finch, and I'm the Lunder Curator of American Art at the Colby College Museum of Art. The Colby Museum organized Marsden-Hartley's Maine with the Metropolitan Museum, and it premiered in New York at the Metropolitan, and then traveled here recently and opened a couple weeks ago here in Waterville, Maine. As the Lunder Curator of American Art, I focus on American art and also work with contemporary artists in a more international scope. So my range is wider than simply American art.
Thank you.
I'm Donna Cassidy. I'm professor of art history and American and New England studies at the University of Southern Maine. And I was brought into this project because I have a background of interest and research on Marsden-Hartley. I published a book on Hartley and New England regional identity in 2005. And so I think that's what drew me to this particular project. And I've published a lot on Hartley and New England regionalism over my career. At the University of Southern Maine, I teach a wide variety of courses from 19th and 20th century European art to American art and gender and modern art. And for a long time, I had taught in the American and New England Studies program. And that program really focused on the question of region and place and how artists and writers and public culture is engaged in creating that sense of place.
That sense of place, I know we're going to hear throughout the rest of this conversation, really seems very important to Marsden-Hartley, right? And last but not least, Randy?
Yeah, my name is Randy Griffey, and I'm curator in the Department of Modern Contemporary Art at the Metropolitan, and I wrote my doctoral dissertation on Hartley many, many years ago when I got interested in Hartley in graduate school. And at the Met, I focus on American modernism primarily. And the Met, like Colby, actually, has a good fortune of having great depth in the collection of works by Marsden-Hartley. So in many ways, one reason this project was natural for the two institutions was that it's in a way rooted in strengths in the collection. I guess we can talk a little bit more about sort of how the project came
yes.
about. I had a previous life as a curator at Amherst College, not so far from Colby, or at least closer to Colby than I am now. And at that point, Beth and I started talking about possibly doing something focused on Hartley at Colby, that I might maybe just write something. And for a project she had in mind with Donna. And when I came to the Met, Beth and I started talking about this project again, and then we arranged that the two institutions would actually partner. And so the project grew a little bit, probably in scale, and then it became a two-venue exhibition. Because, of course, Hartley was between New York and Maine for so much of his career, so it made sense.
I'm wondering, based on the depth of the collections and the collaboration, how did you go about selecting the works that would appear in the exhibition?
It was, we started first by getting a sense of all the works out there that seemed potentially to be within the focus. And I would say that the Maine focus, meaning the state of Maine focus, emerged through conversations initially with Donna and then reaching out to Randy. So it really became an ongoing conversation that I think is still emerging throughout as the exhibition has opened and traveled here. But we began to realize that there was a story to be told that hadn't been told or had been told in ways that maybe misrepresented aspects of Hartley's career related to his place of origin. And Colby College had been given six paintings by Marston Hartley by the artist Alex Katz, who has very close ties to Maine and New York, just as Hartley did. And so we realized here at Colby that we could focus on Maine works. So that was the initial impetus there for us. But when we were developing the checklist, we first needed to understand everything that was out there that might be related to this theme, this focus. And then I think, I don't know, Donna and Randy, you might want to add there, but it just became a part of this conversation and an editing process to figure out how to tell the stories we wanted to tell around this project.
Yeah, I think it was basically a three-way conversation constantly with checklists going back and forth and editing. And I think we were also trying for certain things, like getting as many works that haven't been seen very much out of private collections, for example. Works like Hartley's glass paintings that have rarely been shown and are in private collections, and having particular big themes like Katahdin well represented with a dramatic series of canvases that would have a powerful visual impact on the viewer. So yeah, so those were certainly some of the things that we were trying to keep in mind, you know, bringing some surprises in with, again, works that hadn't been seen, and, you know, and really trying to create as powerful a visual impact as well as the conceptual impact on the viewer.
Well, and based on viewing the book, I can confirm to our listeners there is an incredible array. There are many images and some surprises, which leads me to another question. You mentioned telling the story of Marston Hartley, or maybe correcting parts of the story. And one of the real, I found very interesting points in the catalog is Marsley's quest to be the painter from Maine. And I wondered if you would discuss a little bit the story you seek to tell through the exhibition and how that might relate to his quest to be the painter from Maine.
Randy, this one's made for you.
Well, it's made for all of us, but I'll take a swing at it. So Hartley, through the last few years of his life, did promote himself as the painter from Maine, sort of in all caps. And looking back from the perspective of the 21st century, that might seem like a little bit of a strange thing for an artist to do. But it was, for Hartley, it operated in a range of ways. I mean, I think part of the story that Beth is alluding to is this sort of range of Hartley's public identification and personal identification with his home, which is, on one hand, Hartley really craved a place to call home for a range of reasons that we may or may not get into in the course of this conversation. But on the other hand, in the 30s, in the heyday of regionalism, so-called regionalism in American art, which is to say Grant Wood, Thomas Hart Benton, John Stuart Curry, and so on, there was also great pressure that Hartley felt to identify with a place and to make his viewing public convinced and his critics convinced that he was connected to that place. So the range I'm alluding to is, on one hand, sort of deeply felt personally, but also there is a kind of purpose about that, deliberateness about his public identification with place and Maine. And with regard to Maine as an artist, you know, he had a great legacy to identify with, and specifically, you know, the the artists who preceded him associated with Maine, most of all Winslow Homer. And so Hartley, in a way, goes about from about 1937 on, promoting himself in a way as the second coming of Winslow Homer. I'd invite Beth and Donna to pick up at that point.
Yeah, I think, you know, the other thing about Hartley is, I mean, he was born in Maine, but then leaves Maine, and Beth can talk a little bit about that first coming back to Maine in 1900. But after he left Maine and went to New York and then went to Paris and Germany and started this kind of international travel, right, from about 1912 until 1936, where he was in Europe, where he was in Nova Scotia, he was in Mexico, he was in southern France. And throughout his writings during this time, we find someone who is constantly making references back to Maine. And so he claimed later in his career that, you know, Maine was always with him, and tried to make that argument to his patrons and critics, which didn't always fly very well. But he, you know, for example, when he was in Paris in 1924-25, he was invited to be part of an exhibition of American artists, and he painted two Maine landscapes to be part of that exhibition. So in a sense, that was a moment where he proclaimed internationally that he was a painter of Maine, and certainly tried to use Maine as a way to identify himself as an American artist. He did that in Paris in 1924-25, and he would do that again later in his career in 1937. It really became impossible for him to maintain that life of that international artist in the context of xenophobia and in the context of nativism and the context of regionalism in the 1920s and 1930s, especially. That's Dion.
You know, I think I would just add that in that first return, so he left as a teenager, joined his family, his father who had remarried, Hartley's mother died when he was quite young. He was just 8 when his mother died. He eventually joined his father and his stepmother in Cleveland, and was able to secure a stipend as a young artist to study in New York. And he did return to Maine in search of what he understood to be his subject, which was the Maine landscape, or at least he knew landscape was going to be his subject, and he came to Maine to find it. So that was something that was we felt was important to highlight, that the Maine Hartley ultimately embraced in his early career was quite distinct from the Maine of his upbringing, which was Lewiston. And anyone who knows Maine knows that Lewiston was then and is to a certain degree still now an industrial area, or now it's post-industrial. But at the time, it was truly was one of the great centers of the textile industry. So those first paintings that Hartley found, or the area Hartley found to sort of claim for his art, was an adopted Maine, and it was on the border with New Hampshire, looking to the White Mountains, spectacularly beautiful area in an area called Level, Maine, with a lake along it. And there he discovered as well some of the subjects that span the full length of or full trajectory of his career. Most notably the mountain. So mountain subjects became quite prominent, but also a kind of compositional schema that he would use repeatedly. So water in the foreground, and this mountain pushing forward, often with trees on to the left and right, framing those elements, and sometimes the suggestion of a settlement or farm that he could use over and over in his career. And we wanted to highlight as well, in that early period, which I think people don't know as well, and has sometimes been seen as derivative, just truly how radical it was in advance of the German paintings for which he's so well known, and perhaps best known. So that was something that we felt was important to represent in the selections we made for the exhibition, and then also how we addressed it in the various essays.
Yes, and your comments make me think about another argument that is presented in the book, that landscape was a modernist testing ground for Hartley. And I wonder if you might elaborate on that idea.
Donna, do you want to?
Well, I don't know if landscape per se, but certainly in those early works in particular, we see an artist who is experimental, who is seeing the landscape, but at the same time not representing it in detail as he would have seen it. It's being transformed by this modernist eye, right, that is abstracting, it's exaggerating the colors that he's seeing, creating a highly textured canvas or board in which, you know, you can still see subject matter, but increasingly, and especially in some of the works that he produces during this time, we see a landscape that is very close to abstraction. The patterns of birch trees are in the thick of an autumnal foliage. And, you know, so these works were definitely a place where he could, you know, again, test out those ideas. And we can kind of see the same thing operating in those late paintings. It's a different visual language, in a sense, that he's using in many ways. But it's still, it's not naturalistic. It's primitivist. It's rough and rugged style. And the figures are treated in, you know, in a unnaturalistic manner, exaggerated forms. And so Hartley's, you know, trying to, I think, in those late May paintings, kind of taking the language of regionalism and really making it something very personal and something very modern that is, you know, different from his much more realistic counterparts, like Grant Wood, for example, and most dramatically, I think.
It's really common.
I would just add that it was, you know, it was a modernism that had, and I think you've alluded to this, Donna, but a sort of anti-modern side to it. So not representing the industry that he grew up in, and looking also to ways. So for instance, there's a drawing called Old Maid Crocheting, a title that Hartley gave that work, an interest in subjects of, you know, perhaps ways that are passing away or that had passed away by the early 20th century. So a modernism that is somehow separate from the life he lived, which was quite cosmopolitan.
A really example of that anti-modernity, too, are those series of glass paintings that he did, which were, again, drawing from the past, drawing from this folk tradition, folk art tradition of reverse paintings on glass, but using that manner to create flat, decorative style, again, a kind of abstracted style that many modernist artists saw as being much more authentic, expressive, and real in terms of the artist's emotions. So that sense of you know, that particular period when he's in a Gunquit 1917 painting these paintings on glass, he's using a language that is very modernistic and really expressing himself as he had also seen German artists between 1913 and 15, when he was in Germany. Artists like Kandinsky and Gabriele Munter were also working in the same technique. So, again, drawing from, experimenting from all of these different strains that we see in his main paintings.
Kristen, do you want me to?
Sure, please.
Well, it just would reiterate the point that it's in a kind of an oxymoron, but it is a kind of anti-modern modernism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Hartley was engaged in so many strains of early 20th century American modernism, but the one strain he completely missed, and it's revealing to me that this is the case, but the kind of streamlined industrial aesthetic of somebody like Charles Sheeler, or even to some extent O'Keeffe, despite the fact that he and O'Keeffe are often discussed in similar terms, but that kind of streamlined, slick aesthetic never came from Hartley's brush. And that, I think, is revealing in the sense that, as Don and Beth were saying, is his sensibilities from beginning to end, always gravitated to the kind of anti-modern modernisms, and I would put that in the plural, throughout his entire career. And this show, I think, means to kind of call that out through the lens of Maine, which, as Beth said from the very beginning, he omitted the industrial Maine. And his landscape of Maine isn't even populated in most cases, or in any case, really, let alone industrialized.
So we learned from this conversation and from the book that you mentioned oxymoron, a little contradiction. What a complex character Hartley really was. And another expression I recall, an ambivalent prodigal son. So if we bring together these ideas, another question, I guess, must be the assessment of Hartley. In particular, Clement Greenberg, I believe, had a few things to say about Hartley. So how does he come down to us?
Beth, do you want to kick that off?
Sure. I mean, I'll go back to referring to the Hartley's German paintings. At the time of Hartley's death, he was gained some recognition. He was having exhibitions, and artworks were being purchased by private collectors and prominent museums. The first painting, Randy, to enter the collection of the Metropolitan was the Lobsterman painting, right? Right. So he gained the success he had long been seeking through the Maine works. And if you look at the obituaries that appeared in Time magazine and Life magazine, they all reference in various ways his connection to Maine. I think the Time magazine has a headline that says "The Maine Man." And Life magazine says something to the effect of "Fame finally catches up with the poet painter of Maine." So Hartley died having gained that success he'd been seeking. But in the post-war era, those Maine paintings fell out of the regionalism in general, fell out of favor. And in large part because of people like Clement Greenberg. And it was the German paintings that became the most famous, and perhaps the most famous of all of those is Portrait of a German Officer, which is also in the Met's collection. So that was something we felt needed to be corrected, that a better sense of where things were historically at the time of Hartley's death. And there was something else I wanted to add there, but maybe you two want to chime in with something there related to that? No.
I think, I would just elaborate on Beth's point that the show and the book aspires to align Hartley's output as an artist with the way in which he felt that he would be remembered. It would never have occurred to Hartley in a million years that Portrait of a German Officer, one of the, great German pictures, that would be how he's known in textbooks. Because during his lifetime, those pictures, at least in the U.S., were very coolly received. There wasn't so much a market or demand for a kind of European modernist aesthetic in the States when he showed those here in New York. So, again, we're in a way trying to write, and when I say write, I mean R-I-G-H-T, not W-R-I-T-E, right history, with regard to Hartley through the lens of Maine. It's actually, I'm one of the reasons I love this project so much is it's audacious to omit, as we did, his most famous works. And we did. They were not, even at the Met, where we, as Beth said, we hold Portrait of a German Officer. It wasn't in the exhibition. It was alluded to, but there was nowhere to be found in the exhibition.
And I would just add, too, that it was that first group of main paintings that first brought Hartley to kind of attention, to the attention of Alfred Stieglitz. So that first main period, too, has its own history, and our attempt to kind of recover the significance and importance of that as a moment when Hartley kind of became known as not necessarily the main painter, but certainly a leading avant-garde painter that launched his career and allowed him to go to Paris and do all these other things. So that first main period, too, I think has a great significance. And re-looking at that period in terms of not so much the main subjects, but certainly the, again, that avant-garde style, the experimental style that we see operating in those works is really important.
And to just add there, too, is that that great early period has really been lost in the shadow of the German period that followed. And so this was also, I think, the goal of the show is to bring that work out from under that shadow.
Kirsten, I wanted to go back to something you mentioned about the complexity of Hartley and this issue of ambivalence. I think having had the pleasure of being in the galleries and seeing the paintings here and also in New York and drawings for that matter, which are an important component of this project, that's one thing that seems to resonate with people is this, because it is an exhibition about one artist's connection and deployment or evocation in various ways of his place of origin, that he played it both ways, or he felt it both ways. So a good example of that is in the late works, there's a painting entitled Ghosts of the Forest. It's a work in the collection of the Brooklyn Museum. And just next to it here in the installation here is a painting called Abundance. So in one case, Ghosts of the Forest are these logs that have been stranded on a beach, forlorn. Somehow they never really entered the market or came to much use, it would be suggested, and perhaps is suggesting as well, since they were painted just prior to Hartley's death or in the years prior to Hartley's death, that there's some kind of suggestion of reflection on end of life. And then a work like Abundance, which has piles of logs piled up high, really filling the entire picture plane as if they were some sort of mountain in their own right. So that sense of a relationship to place that is quite personal, but also has national significance. So Maine, not simply being Maine, but Maine that regionally figured within how New England was conceptualized at that moment and really across the span or much of the first half of the 20th century.
Yeah, and that complexity carries over to, again, the way that he represents Maine, in that he said at one point that he was not a Book of the Month Club painter, and yet he certainly draws from a lot of the very popular imagery of the time, the, you know, pictures of lighthouses along the shore, waves crashing along the coast, images that were really part of the tourist culture. But when we look at those paintings by Hartley, there's something askew. There's something it's a little dark. There's something that's not quite right. The Portland, in the painting of Portland Headlight, that lighthouse seems like it's going to be toppled over by the waves. It's not that very solid form that guides fishermen and sailors, right? Or many of his late landscapes have this dark tonality to it, not this kind of bland lightness that certainly is part of, again, the popular imagery of time and popular painters of the early part of the 20th century. So there definitely is this kind of dark side of Hartley, this kind of Stephen King side of Hartley's Maine, where we see that dark and destructive quality that appears in his very early works and is a constant theme throughout his paintings, throughout his career.
With this said, I'm trying to picture him teaching painting to students at the Bangor Society of Art. I think this was earlier in his career. How did he interact, I would say, with the public, or if he was with students, can you speak to his, what would that be, another persona that he adopted when he was in that type of role?
I don't know that we have a lot of records of his interactions with students, and I would hazard a guess that he wasn't a particularly successful teacher since the examples or moments that he made an attempt to do so were really quite brief and short. I think there was an attempt to do so when he was in Lewiston in 1906, as well as in Bangor, I think in 1939. I don't know of any records or responses to Hartley as a teacher. He did try to create, though, this kind of public persona. I mean, there's a wonderful photograph of him in the Bangor Daily News, you know, standing next to a Katahdin painting, and he's dressed with a kind of flannel shirt, looking very much like the Maynor, the kind of working class Maynor that he was trying to identify with at that time. Again, I don't know how well that sold to Bangor audiences, but it certainly was part of the selling of him and his paintings to a New York audience during this particular time period.
It is hard not to laugh, to smile a little bit, to think about the proud, in a way, autodidact, actually teaching art, right? I mean, because he prided himself on having so little formal training himself. So I don't know how well that scenario would translate into the classroom. Like Donna said, it was pretty brief.
I mean, he made great efforts too to try to cultivate an audience in Maine. But I think, again, that was somewhat less successful. He did, there were all these letters where he's trying to get a stamp of approval as a painter and poet of Maine from the state librarian of Maine, which he eventually does. But he wanted to have exhibitions in Maine. And so it's really, quite bittersweet that he finally does have this great exhibition at Colby about his Maine paintings, and all of these paintings that he did of Maine are kind of brought back.
Remind me, Donna, isn't it in that exchange of letters he suggests that he may leave all of his remaining work to the state, right? I mean, wasn't the plan on leaving a great body of work to the state? It never happened, but he's very serious about it.
Yeah, and I think it was that drive to really cultivate that identity as the main artist, and not just for the New York audience, to really connect back with his homeland.
And he gave a painting in 1907, I think, or 1908, to the Lewiston Public Library. It's one of it's the earliest surviving work in this exhibition. There's one slightly earlier painting. He painted the facade or the front of an image of Walt Whitman's home. But that even that gesture of giving a painting to a place that he had at that point used quite a bit. He used the Lewiston Public Library, which was a quite new Carnegie Library at that point. It did not exist when he left Lewiston as a teenager. It was there when he returned, and he made good use of it. And I think what you mentioned, Randy, of being a sort of self-taught to a certain degree, even though he did have formal training, much of that he set aside in how he went about painting, and was self-taught also, I think, as a writer. He was a writer who learned by reading, and I think one of the fascinations of this project and of Hartley generally is how much he loved to read, and how closely he would identify with the writers and the artists with whom he identified. So he would feel them, when you read him writing either his essays or if he's referring to artists he loves and admires in his letters. It's a real sense of kinship. It's quite a strong identification, and I think that is that comes through in his work as well.
I was interested to note from reading your book that he was strongly influenced by Gertrude Stein, right? Wrote an autobiography. Is that also in a stream of consciousness type of a style, or more ordered, I guess?
Hart, Bradley's autobiography actually exists in several different forms, but it is pretty. It's unlike Gertrude Stein's writing, but I think her autobiography, Alice We Told, this is perhaps one of her most readable books, right? And Hartley's autobiography is very much chronological and very understandable in that way. I mean, it's also a document that I think, you know, he's writing late in his career, and so a lot of his retrospective thoughts, I think, have to be kind of taken with a grain of salt. I think he's really, you know, looking back at a time, you know, where he's initially a fairly unsuccessful artist still in the 1930s when he starts to write this. So, yeah, I don't know how much more than certainly the idea of writing an autobiography after reading Gertrude Stein's autobiography was really what inspired him, more so than the form or actually her usual way of writing.
Mm-hmm. It's really intriguing. You know, as I'm reading through the book, I hear everything you're saying. This kind of regionalist approach and identity. And then suddenly we have Gertrude Stein and other very avant-garde figures popping in. So for those who are listening, the stories of Marsden Hartley that we get from the exhibition, the catalog, they will challenge things we were probably all taught in our art history classes. And maybe as a last question, I would like to ask you, do you have another project on the burner now?
Not as this trio, as much as we would like there to be. So, you know, who knows in the future, we're all working on various things. We're here related to the exhibition at Colby. We're organizing a symposium that will take place here on October 6th. And Donna, we're very honored, will be the keynote, and Randy will also be here for that. So related to this, that's immediately on the horizon here. And that will focus on New England modernism in relation to regionalism specifically. And we'll look kind of past into the post-war era. So regionalism we normally associate particularly with the 20s and 30s. It will look deeper into the 20th century, in particular to take in important places, some of the artist colonies that were developed here earlier. So starting in the early 20th century and then later with places quite close to here in Waterville, Maine, like the Skowhegan School of Painting and Sculpture, which has been so influential. So that's something related specifically to the exhibition that we'll all be involved with in some way. Is there something you two wanted to mention?
Well, as Beth said, this trio isn't cooking anything up right at the moment, but, you know, hope springs eternal that something maybe again down the road will. I mean, Hartley is always a presence, you know, in the two museums involved because the collections, as I said, you know, so, you know, Hartley, the collections are strong in the artist's work. So Hartley will always be present. And I mean, I think for me, and I guess this is going off topic just a little bit, what I think is wonderful about the moment that we're in kind of intellectually and art historically is that, you know, that this art from the 30s can be looked at kind of with fresh eyes, I think, because a generation of art historians were really, or even more than one generation, was trained to really dismiss it outright as kitsch and as nativist in a very narrow way. And, you know, some of my work at the Met, including this project, has been, I think, to push back against this knee-jerk reaction against artists of the 30s that has, again, kind of worked its way through a generational shift. But I guess I'll just leave it at that.
Making this project all the more important, I would argue, in terms of just the scope of art history, another reason for those who are listening to definitely get the book and, in, you know, get more about the new storytelling and the changes that the curators we're speaking with really want to see happen, and working, of course, always from the art itself. Is there anything else you would like in the final moments here to tell us about the exhibition or anything? I know we couldn't cover everything, which means people need to buy the book.
I just wanted to mention that there's also a great chapter in the book by two Met conservators, Isabel Duvernois and Rachel Mustalish. We were lucky here at Colby to send our loans to the exhibition a good year and a half in advance. And we used that pool of works, the Colby College works, and also the works in the Met collection, so something around 14 or 15 works. They used them to analyze and better understand Hartley's materials and methods, and we're able to publish new research on that. So that's something we're very proud of.
And I would add, too, just as an additional plug for the book, is that there's a chapter on Hartley's writing, new writing on Hartley's own writing about Maine, by the head of creative writing at Yale University, Richard Deming. So, you know, Beth and Dawn and I touch at different points in our work on Hartley's writing, but Richard really focuses more in depth on it. So there's that dimension of Hartley's artistry in the book as well.
Right, and last but not least, in fact, it's the first thing in the book, I believe, is a great chronology by Andrew Gelfand, who until recently was a curatorial fellow here at the Colby Museum. And it places Hartley and Maine in the in a national context, and includes some of those great images that are in the book and throughout the essays as well.
Yes, that's a fantastic element, I felt, of the book. The timeline, cultural events, more than the typical timeline. Well, I would like to thank all of you so much for speaking with us today. And again, we were speaking with Donna Cassidy, Elizabeth Finch, and Randy Griffey. And the book, which is distributed by Yale University Press and published by the Metropolitan Museum of Art, is certainly available. And again, thank you for listening today.
Thank you, Kristen.
Thank you. Thank you very much.